Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Beau Fernald, Vice Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your co-chair today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Martin Ford. Martin Ford has over 25 years' experience in the fields of computer design and software development. He holds a computer engineering degree from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and a graduate business degree from the University of California, Los Angeles. He has written for publications including Fortune, Forbes, The Atlantic, Washington Post, Project Syndicate, The Huffington Post, and The Fiscal Times. He has also appeared on numerous radio and television shows, including NPR and CNBC. Martin is a frequent keynote speaker on the subject of accelerating progress in robotics and artificial intelligence, and what these advances mean for the economy, job market, and the society of the future. Finally, he is also the author of the books The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation Accelerating Technology in the Economy of the Future, and his latest, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. Please welcome Martin Ford.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this. It's really a pleasure to be here. Okay, thank you. So this book is really my attempt to contribute to or maybe even initiate a conversation that I think is going to be critically important to us over the next couple of decades. I think that there are good reasons to believe that we could be on the leading edge of a big disruptive wave that's really just going to put a terrific amount of pressure on society and also on our economy. And the central idea, of course, is that machines and computers and algorithms are going to increasingly take over more work in the economy. They're going to displace workers. And most importantly, they're going to take over a lot of the work that people are now paid to do. And I think that down the line, that can lead to big problems for us. There have been a number of people, primarily in the academic world, that have tried to sort of quantify this, to get a handle on it, and to come up with some sort of a reasonable estimate as to exactly how many jobs are likely to be threatened by automation. And the numbers that they're coming back with are pretty alarming. Depending on the country that they're looking at and the particular assumptions that they're making, they're coming back with estimates that range from typically 30% all the way up to 60% of all the jobs in the economy could potentially be automated. The highest profile study that was done in the United States was undertaken by a couple of researchers at Oxford University, and they came to the conclusion that just about half of the jobs in the United States could be automated within the next 20 years or so. So those are pretty frightening numbers. The assumption or the approach that really underlies these kinds of studies is that if any job is on some level fundamentally routine, repetitive, and predictable, then it seems very likely that eventually a robot or an algorithm is going to come along and be able to automate that job. And the problem is that that, you know, constitutes a whole lot of jobs in the economy. Most people come to work and they tend to do the same kinds of basic things again and again. The word that is very often used to describe the kinds of jobs that might be susceptible is routine, and I think that's a bit misleading because it tends to make you believe that it really applies only to jobs that are rote repetitive. And yet, technology has already gone far beyond that. We can already give many examples of how algorithms and machines are able to do far more than simply automate assembly line type work. So I think that a better word to use that's really more descriptive is predictable. If you have a job that is where most of the tasks that you undertake are predictable based on what you've done in the past, then it's a pretty good bet that eventually a smart algorithm is going to figure out how to do that. One way to think of it is to ask, could another smart person, if they had access to a very detailed record of everything you've done in the past, or if perhaps they were able to watch you work, would they eventually be able to figure out how to do your job? And if the answer to that is yes, then I think it's a pretty good bet that eventually a smart algorithm or a robot will quite likely be able to do that job. If, on the other hand, you're creating something genuinely new all the time, then perhaps your job, at least for the foreseeable future, is safe. But the problem is that not many people are really engaged in that kind of genuinely creative work, and especially not many people are really paid to do that. So that doesn't necessarily offer us much of a safety net. Most people tend to do relatively routine, predictable things, and so it's a whole lot of people that are subject to this. So if you really sit down and think what it would mean for our society and our economy if somewhere between 30 and 60% of the jobs were basically to evaporate over the next couple of decades, I mean, it's hard to think of too many things that would be more dramatic than that in terms of their, you know, the impact on society. And the thing is that the things you can think about, or the things that you can think of that might be bigger, are all, you know, uniformly negative. There's things like wars and plagues and big asteroids and things like that. So this is something that I think is really worth thinking about. It's something that could potentially have a very, very disruptive impact on our society, and it's important to, I think, initiate a conversation about this, and that's really the point of what I'm doing with this book. So I thought that the place I would start before I talk specifically about what's in the book, I'd tell you a little bit about my background and how I got to thinking about this and writing about this. Back in the early to mid-1990s, I started a very small software company in Silicon Valley. And it by small, I mean that it was basically just me in my apartment. I started by writing a program. And but back then, running a small software business was a pretty labor-intensive process. Software was shipped on physical media, on CD-ROMs. If you wanted to sell commercial software, then people expected it to be accompanied by a printed manual. And so there was a fair amount of work there involved in producing that and also in fulfilling it, you know, in packing it up and shipping it to customers and so forth. So there was work and there was jobs there for average people. And as my business grew, I eventually ended up outsourcing much of that work to another little company that was actually located up in Berkeley. And they hired lots of people at different skill levels, not necessarily people that had lots of education, to undertake all that kind of routine work in terms of filling the software and responding to customer orders and so forth. But what I found is that in a relatively short time, most of that work just evaporated. And now, of course, software is delivered, if it's delivered at all, over the internet. There really isn't any physical media shipped at all. Very often, software is not even delivered. It's just hosted in the cloud, and people will access it remotely. So those jobs basically kind of evaporated, and in fact, that other small business that I had outsourced the work to actually went out of business in the early 2000s. So, you know, there have been big changes just in this small industry that I was a part of, and of course, you've seen something similar in industries like music and journalism and so forth that have been impacted by this kind of digital onslaught. So that really put me in the position of, first of all, being very close to the technology. Since I was working with software, I saw how computers continued to accelerate and how the whole technology in terms of building new software was getting better and better. And at the same time, I saw the changes that it caused in my own little business. So I was very close to that. So as a result of that, I really started to think about this, and I came to the conclusion that what we were seeing in industries like software and music and journalism was really kind of a preview of what was likely to happen in the entire economy as technologies like robotics and artificial intelligence sort of came online. And pretty soon we would see this same kind of thing happening even in those areas of the economy that involved producing tangible products, for example. So at that point, as I thought more about that, I started writing about it. And that's when I wrote my first book. And the title of that was The Lights in the Tunnel. And that referred to kind of a thought experiment that I used in the book to sort of explore what might happen to the economy if lots of the jobs got automated. And that was actually a self-published book. Back then, this entire issue was not even on the radar. It was considered very much a fringe, almost kind of a crazy idea. And so I wasn't actually able to find a publisher for that first book, so I self-published it. But over time, and especially over the last 5 years or so, as this issue has drawn more attention, the book did well enough to lead to an opportunity to write this this new book, Rise of the Robots, which is, of course, a traditionally published book. So that's sort of how I got into this. And again, the point is really to sort of initiate a conversation about this, which I think is just a critical issue. So this is a book that covers a fair amount. So what I'd like to do is just touch on a few of the really main topics that I think are especially important. The first thing that I do in the book is really take on what is perhaps the central question to all of this, and it's a question that comes up again and again. It's the question that I get asked more than anything else, and that is, why would this time be different relative to what has happened in the past? This idea that machines and technology will displace workers and potentially create lots of unemployment is something that goes back at a minimum 200 years to the Luddite revolt in England. And since then, it's come up again and again. In my book, I talk a little bit about the Triple Revolution Report, which is actually a formal report that was put together by a very high-profile group of people in the 1960s. And it was actually presented to President Johnson. And this report warned that we were, you know, back in 1964, really on the cusp of a big disruption that was going to potentially, you know, put just enormous stress on society back then and create massive unemployment. Obviously, that did not happen. And the fact is that this warning has been raised again and again, and it always turns out to be a false alarm. So there is, I think, a lot in common between this story and the story of the little boy who cries wolf. And, of course, in that story, the false alarm is raised again and again, and the population becomes kind of skeptical. They become complacent. But then in the end, the wolf does ultimately show up, and then it doesn't go too well for the people who are skeptical. So I think that there are good reasons to be a little bit concerned that that's what could happen again, that we could be leading in that direction where we're not going to be well prepared for this disruption when it happens. This is an issue that sits at the intersection of economics and technology. And economists never want to hear that this time is different. They're always very, very skeptical of that. Whereas with technology, this time is always different. I mean, that's the whole point of innovation, that you're always going to a place that you've never been before. You know, with technology, things are always new all the time. So one of the, I think, most fundamental questions here is this really something that's about economics or is it about technology? And I tend to come down on the side of technology. I think that there isn't any universal law of the universe or even of economics that says that people always have to be in the loop, that people are always essential to the production process. I think it's entirely possible that eventually machines can evolve to the point where they can do almost all of the work that needs to be done in the economy in order to produce all the goods and the services that that consumers demand and that consumers want. And we can see many examples of that already. If you look, for example, at how people are now spending their time, the new kinds of products and services that people want. I mean, they want to spend hours with Facebook. They want to spend time on Twitter. They want to spend time playing video games. I think that in the near future, people will probably spend a great deal of time in virtual reality environments. Those are all products and services which there may be a role for people in their initial creation, but once the ball is rolling and services are being delivered, there really isn't much role for people at all in terms of their ongoing delivery. So you can already see how much of our economy is evolving towards new products and services that simply don't have much role for human beings in terms of their general operation. What you see instead is that the services are being delivered by these huge computing centers. So I think that sort of gives us a leading indicator of where we're likely headed there. And there are examples in history that you can point to where disruptions have happened suddenly and have been very sudden and unexpected. One good example is what happened with the Wright brothers when they first worked on powered flight. At that time, people were enormously skeptical that they would succeed at that. There were people that said, no one is going to build a working airplane in 1,000 years. People thought that it would never work, or other people thought that even if they achieved powered flight, it would never be good for anything. It would never be a practical invention. It would never have any useful impact on society. And obviously, that turned out to be dramatically wrong. And yet, it's difficult to be too hard on the people that were skeptical because there was plenty of evidence to suggest that, in fact, it wasn't going to happen. There was basically all of human history that said, people just don't get into heavier-than-air contraptions and fly through the air. And there were any number of really spectacular failures. People watched again and again as people tried to build airplanes and crashed spectacularly. So you can't blame people for being skeptical, and yet that is a reality that just shifted in an instant. Within a few seconds, what used to be true was no longer true, and powered flight was a reality, and now it's become something that has just had an enormous impact on our society. And I think that as we look to the future of artificial intelligence and robotics, there's a lesson to be learned from that, that, you know, things can happen quite suddenly and they can have really kind of an overwhelming impact. So if we really want to talk about what exactly is different and why it's different from the past, I think a good place to start is with the story that almost anyone who is skeptical about this brings up, and that is what happened with agriculture in the United States. It used to be that nearly everyone at one point worked on a farm, and now today almost no one works on a farm. It's less than 2% of our workforce. So there were millions and millions of jobs that were destroyed by technology in the agricultural sector. And yet it clearly hasn't been a bad thing for us. It's been a very good thing. People have moved on to other types of work. They've found more rewarding, more fulfilling work that often requires a higher skill level. Food is much cheaper relative to our incomes than it was before, so we're all much better off. We now have more money to spend on other things, so it's worked out great. So a skeptic will look at this and they will say, you know, we had such a positive experience, at least over the long term, in terms of this disruption that occurred in agriculture. Isn't it just going to be the same again? Aren't we going to see the same thing this time around? And I would argue that there are good reasons to worry that maybe not, maybe that it's not going to be the same. And there are really three particular things that I would point to in order to illustrate that. The first is that today's technology is, of course, advancing exponentially. We've got this accelerating progression going on. The most well-known aspect of that is Moore's Law, which applies to the computer hardware. But in fact, we're seeing an acceleration that's much more broad-based than that. It includes, for example, communications bandwidth. It includes what's happening in a lot of areas of software. We're also seeing this acceleration. So what we see is that this technology has effectively been doubling. And the important thing is not just the fact that it's been doubling, but that that doubling has been going on for so long. I mean, if you take something and you double it again and again and again, you keep doing that for decades, you end up at a point where you just really have an incredible amount of absolute progress. You can think of it in terms of getting in your car and gradually doubling your speed. Start at 5 miles per hour and just keep doubling your speed gradually. If you do that just a handful of times, you would need a racetrack. If you could do it 25 or 30 times, which is the number of times that we've seen that happen in information technology since roughly the late 1950s, then you know, you'd be traveling at millions of miles per hour. So that's sort of where we are today with this technology. It's just moving at a really rapid rate now. And that's part of the reason that things are kind of unfolding at a rate that is really beyond what we might expect. The second quality that I would point to is the fact that information technology, at least to a limited extent, now encapsulates machine intelligence. So you actually see machines that, in a limited sense, can think. They can make decisions. They can solve problems. And most importantly, they can learn. And that's obviously dramatically different from the mechanical technologies that transformed agriculture. And the third and perhaps most important thing is that this technology is very broad-based. It's really a general-purpose technology. It's going to invade the entire economy. It's not limited just to one sector the way this agricultural technology was. And what that means is that it's going to really transform every part of the economy, every industry, every employment sector, and it's going to transform the industries that exist today and also the ones that arise in the future. You hear a lot about this idea of creative destruction, the idea that things may be destroyed today, but then newer industries will arise in the future, and that's certainly true. But you can see already by looking at some of the industries that have arisen recently, things like Google and Facebook and Amazon and so forth, they're very technology intensive. They simply don't employ many people, and I think that's what the future looks like. You can easily imagine some of the industries that will be important in the future, things like nanotechnology and synthetic biology and probably virtual reality. Those will all be, I'm sure, important industries, but they're just not going to employ many people. There, in particular, aren't going to be a lot of roles for average people because they're so technology intensive. So as we look forward, I think if you put these three things together, what you end up with is something that looks almost like a utility, almost like electric power. But instead of just delivering power, it's actually delivering intelligence. It's delivering machine intelligence that can very often substitute for what workers can do. And it's kind of scaling across the whole economy. And I think that that really has the potential to make everything less labor intensive and simply to eliminate a lot of jobs. The next point that I really focus on in the book, which I think is really important, is that our conventional assumption about the types of jobs that are most susceptible to this is really not correct. We tend to think of factory jobs, for example, or low-skilled jobs being most susceptible to automation. And then the conventional solution, given that it's mostly low-skilled jobs, is that we should send people back to school. So if you lose your job in a factory or a warehouse, then what we want to do is send you back to school or for some more training, and then maybe you can get a job in an office. That's the way it's supposed to work and the way it has worked historically. But what we see now is that this technology is really coming after many of the higher-skilled jobs as well. And in fact, it is the case that if you have a kind of white-collar, knowledge-based job where you're sitting in front of a computer doing relatively routine information manipulations, that type of job is actually often more susceptible to automation than many low-skill jobs that require things like visual perception and dexterity. A good example would be a person who assists an elderly person, what you would call a home care worker. That type of job is something that we'd really like to automate because we know we're going to have a big demographic problem with an aging population. But in fact, it's incredibly hard to automate. A robot that could actually do that and be affordable and flexible and really autonomously help take care of an elderly person is still science fiction at this point. So that's kind of the paradox as we go forward, is that a lot of the best jobs, the jobs that college graduates might want to take, for example, are relatively susceptible to automation because it only takes software to automate those jobs. Where a lot of the jobs that we might consider a lot less desirable and really don't pay well and don't necessarily require a very high skill level are much harder to automate. So what that suggests is that the conventional solution to this, which is always education, always more and more education and training, may not be effective in the long run. We may need to really consider a more radical solution to all of this. And then a third thing that I really focus on in the book that I think is critically important is that this is not just an issue about individual economic security. I mean, that is obviously critically important. If we have a situation with unemployment or wages are really driven down, that's going to put a lot of stress on people and on the fabric of society. But beyond that, there is also a broader economic issue, and that is that we need to have consumers out there who are capable of buying the products and services that our economy produces. And without that, it's really hard to see how we're going to have continued economic prosperity. Ultimately, individual consumers are the most important driver of economic prosperity and growth. And, that's always been the case since we've had a mass market economy. As things get more and more unequal, you essentially have fewer and fewer viable consumers out there who can really create vibrant demand for the economy and also for innovation. You can think of that kind of in terms of Bill Gates. Someone who's as wealthy as Bill Gates, in theory, has an infinite amount of purchasing power. He can buy anything he wants. But the reality is, of course, is that he doesn't want to just go out and buy anything. He's not going to buy 1,000 cars. He's not going to buy 1,000 smartphones. And he's definitely not going to sit down and buy 1,000, restaurant meals. He's not going to eat 1,000 restaurant meals. So when you take purchasing power, income from 1,000 average people, and you concentrate that into the hands of one person, which is essentially what's been going on in our economy, then you really kind of undermine demand. You take away a lot of the demand that's out there that creates, that really drives economic growth. And that also has an impact on innovation. If you want to have lots of entrepreneurship and lots of innovation in the future, you need to provide a vibrant market for that innovation. You can think in terms of someone like Steve Jobs. I mean, if you were to take him and just drop him on an island where he had no access to a market, then he would be just gathering coconuts like anyone else. He would basically be nothing special. It's critical that he be in a place where he's got a market where he can leverage his talents. Without that, even the most talented, capable person really, isn't worth that much. So it's really important that we have a reasonable distribution of purchasing power. And that's one of the problems that I think we may be running into already. If you look around the world today, for example, in Europe, there's a lot of talk of deflation where you simply don't have enough demand in the economy and prices are falling and unemployment keeps soaring. And it's easy to imagine how you can get into kind of a downward spiral if you don't have enough demand out there, and then businesses continue to cut back, they lay off even more people, and essentially you can, you know, get into a situation where you're just kind of winding down. And I think that that's going to be a real challenge for us in the future if we don't undertake to adapt to this. So I think where this all leads, sort of the bottom line, is that in the future we're going to face a fundamental choice. This clearly does not have to be a bad thing. We can imagine a kind of technological utopia where machines and algorithms and technology take on more and more of the work, where people have to work less, they have more time to do other things, where perhaps no one has to do a job that they really hate. You know, obviously that's a very positive story, and that's the element of this that techno-optimists will tend to focus on. You will hear a very positive story from them. But the problem, of course, is that historically and in today's world, jobs and incomes are attached. I mean, they're a package deal. So if you lose your job, no matter how unpleasant it may be, you also lose your income. And that's something that I think is going to lead to a lot of problems. We're going to find more and more people who simply don't have the ability to find their way in the economy. I think that the risk we face going forward is that we can end up with kind of inequality on steroids as income just concentrates more and more among a tiny number of people at the top who essentially own most of the technology, own the machines, and other people who rely on their labor, especially if what they do is more average routine type work, are going to find it more and more difficult to hang on to anything approaching a middle class lifestyle. And in some cases, they may fall even further than that. I think sort of the extreme case would be the homeless person. And this is something you can find easily in San Francisco. I think a homeless person who has a laptop or some kind of device and can go somewhere that has Wi-Fi and tap into all this digital abundance and can experience all this terrific stuff that the techno-optimists will talk about. You know, you can experience all the entertainment and the free information and so forth, and that's great. But at the same time, they don't have access to what we would consider to be the basic necessities of life. And that's kind of the paradox we face going forward, is that all of this technology absolutely will create lots and lots of abundance, but it can also undermine incomes for a lot of people. And the fact is that in the United States, we simply don't have a very good social safety net relative to other advanced countries. And so a lot of people could be in a position, I think, where, you know, their middle-class lifestyle is certainly threatened, and in some cases even their basic economic security is threatened if we don't adapt to this. And I think that ultimately the adaptation in the long run is going to require that we figure out a way to essentially decouple the job from the income. We're going to have to find a way to move toward a paradigm where even if people don't have a traditional job, they still have access to at least some sort of a basic income. And I think the best way to do that is some sort of a guaranteed income or basic income scheme. That's obviously not a new idea. It's been around for a long time. It's been advocated by people on both sides of the political spectrum, including a lot of conservatives. For example, Friedrich Hayek, who is kind of a conservative icon now, is a big proponent of having a guaranteed income. So it's an idea that's had a lot of support in the past, but in the context of today's politics, it's, you know, pretty much unthinkable. It's you know, it's really hard to imagine how we get to that point. But again, that's the paradox we face. I think that it's just what appears to be a staggering political challenge in order to get to that point. But at the same time, I think that it's inevitable that we will ultimately have to go on that path. I can't say exactly how long it will be before, you know, it becomes inevitable that we have to take on that challenge. But I think that if you look far enough into the future and consider the way technology is going, that eventually we're going to have to make that choice and figure out a way to adapt to that. And that's, again, the primary point of this book, is really to increase awareness about this and hopefully, you know, initiate a conversation so that we can all begin sort of figuring out a way to solve this problem. So I will stop there, and thank you.
Our thanks to Martin Ford for his discussion of Rise of the Robots. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor to questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please raise your hand.
I was a journalist for 35 years doing documentaries for news magazines and things like that. I can't imagine how a robot would do that job.
Well, you know, algorithms are doing the more routine aspects of journalism already. There are already companies like Narrative Science and Automated Insights that can generate news stories. And right now they're focused on more formulaic things like business reporting and sports reporting. But, you know, the question, can our algorithm produce a documentary? At this time, it's the answer to that would be no. I would never say never. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that more and more information and resources are online, and you've already got algorithms that can translate between languages, that can do a lot of really remarkable, unexpected things. So the idea that we might somehow or someday have an algorithm that can find things online and put them together into a documentary, you know, it's not unthinkable, I wouldn't say. That's right. I mean, if you've got to go out and interview human beings individually, then, of course, it's hard for technology to do that. So this isn't something that's going to displace everyone overnight, but there are a lot of people that do jobs that are far more routine and repetitive than that. Right.
So you mentioned that many of the jobs may go away, but clearly some are going to exist that are not all the low-skilled jobs. Where are the jobs of the future going to be? What type of preparation is going to be necessary for them if education and retraining are not sufficient for it?
Well, I think that education will continue to be very important. It's just that it probably won't be a systemic solution. It won't be a solution for everyone. But, you know, the conventional answer to which jobs are going to be safe is that it will be more creative jobs, the jobs that involve things that are genuinely non-routine, like, for example, making documentaries where you have to go out and talk to real people. But the number of documentary makers, you know, as a percentage of the workforce is very, very small. I mean, that's a tiny number of people. So if you add up all the creative jobs in the economy, which includes journalists and actors and artists and all those kinds of people, it's just a tiny number. It's about 1% of our workforce. So those jobs will be relatively safe. I think that the one field that I would say is a pretty good bet if you want to have a safe job right now is healthcare. I think that a lot of aspects of healthcare are very hard to automate, especially something like nursing, where you need a lot of mobility and dexterity and so forth. You know, building a robot that can do that is still science fiction. So I think that, you know, that's a really safe bet. But I would never say never. I mean, if we go out 30, 40, 50 years from now, I mean, who knows? I couldn't say with any certainty that any job will be safe. Sure, up here. Oh. Okay.
It seems like the safest job would be the person designing the AIs. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, if you're a very high-level artificial intelligence researcher, you know, you're one of those people that's got a PhD from MIT or something, yeah, sure, you're safe. On the other hand, if you're a more routine computer programmer, I think that there are definitely lots of efforts underway to automate that. DARPA is running a project right now that's really focused on automating a lot of routine software development. So, again, it's hard to say, you know, with any certainty. One assumption that people make about the far future, if we ever have genuinely intelligent machines, is that one of the things they'll do is design themselves. So at that point, even the AI researcher would be out of luck.
What percent of the workforce is in IT?
I don't know IT, but I can tell you that about 10%, about 8 to 10%, something like that, is what we call STEM fields, which means science, technology, engineering. So, because what we always hear is that people should train more into those fields. You know, that's the conventional solution again, is that rather than studying liberal arts, you ought to go and study engineering or technology or something. But again, that's only about 10% of our workforce, and obviously not everyone is equipped to do those types of jobs. So we can't take our whole population and you know, fit them into that category of work. I don't think that that's going to be a systemic solution going forward. That's right. So, I mean, yeah, I mean.
I'm saying that the transition, you've got 10% of the people playing with computers, 90% are not playing with computers. You're going to have to transition that 90%. You're going to displace those? I don't.
Right, that's the point. I mean, you can't do it. You can't stick the 90% into the 10%, right? You know, there's not going to be enough jobs there. Even if you could train all those people so that they could do a technical job, there wouldn't be enough jobs.
We seem to be really bad at predicting the future when it comes to how technology invades our lives. You know, back in the 70s, we thought our homes would be fully automated very quickly. And today we're lucky if we have a robot that cleans our pool and perhaps for the most technology advanced, the vacuum cleaner that does part of the job. But, you know, most of us still either iron our shirts or have somebody iron them, which seems like a really basic repetitive task. What do you think is different on that front?
Well, we are seeing advances in some very important areas. There's an area known as deep learning, for example, a specific area of machine learning where you see just dramatic advances. There are now computers basically that can recognize images better than people can. I just saw there's a system that can understand a video. These kind of pattern recognition tasks are really an area that traditionally have just been exclusive to human beings, and now you see machines moving into it. But again, a lot of this is in information-related jobs. It's really white-collar jobs that are being threatened. I mean, folding the laundry, as you say, is still, you know, not possible for a robot, really, not practical. So that's sort of the paradox, is that in many cases, it's really the better jobs that involve working with knowledge or information that are more susceptible than, you know, the low skill jobs that just require dexterity.
You noted that there's a big gap between what you think needs to happen, for instance, a guaranteed income, and kind of where we are politically now. I'm curious, have you thought about what it might take to get there? Because obviously the political climate is very against it. You know, the political institutions seem to take crisis in order to make any significant or lasting change. So I'm wondering if you've thought at all what it might take in order to address these problems in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it, and I basically come to the same conclusion that you just indicated. I think that history shows pretty clearly that we don't make big changes unless there's a crisis. I mean, you know, so it seems very likely that if indeed what I'm saying is correct and we are going to have to move to something like a guaranteed income, it will happen only when there's some sort of a crisis, something that is pretty dramatic. I don't think there are many cases in history you can point to where we just got smart and did something really dramatic just, you know, because we thought we needed to. You know, it happens when a crisis hits. So that's a little bit discouraging, yes. And, of course, in today's political environment, we can't even get the most conventional things done. I mean, you know, we can't do anything, basically. So,
thanks for writing this book. It's something at first I sounded crazy talking about after I read Lights in the Tunnel, but it's kind of now becoming more mainstream. I recently saw that Bernie Sanders in an online Q&A actually was asked the question about automation and about the basic income. And he didn't have great hopes for those types of things. But do you wrote this like leading into a presidential cycle. Do you think that this is going to be discussed among, you know, major people running for office? Do you think it should be? And, you know, how do we kind of start talking about this on a more mainstream thing? Because I haven't heard a lot of folks
talking
about it.
It's an interesting question. Did you say Bernie Sanders actually came out in favor of it? I hadn't heard that. But yeah, that's probably what I'd say. But I think it should be discussed. I think it will be fascinating to see if it is in this cycle. I'm kind of surprised that it's already come up. It will be really interesting if some of the major candidates ask this question. I think that it's a toxic issue. I mean, I don't think any of them are really going to want to touch it at all because you know, ultimately the problem is that there is not really a conventional solution to it. If it is discussed, I'm sure that education will be proffered as the solution because that's the only conventional tool in the toolbox. So they'll talk about education. But if you really sit down and think about how things are evolving, especially the fact that these technologies are coming after the higher skilled jobs, is kind of a top heavy impact. It's really hard to see how education is going to solve this. So, you know, I hope that it will be discussed more, and I think it'll be really interesting to see if it is or not.
I don't know all the history of Social Security in this country, but I do have some sense of the history of the Civil Rights Movement. I have some sense of what's going on in the gay movement right now in this country in terms of a shift in values. And so sometimes it's a crisis, but sometimes it's a crisis of compassion as well. So my thought is, the question is, if we can identify those shifts in values that need to take place that are a precursor for this, maybe that's where we should be giving our thoughts to. And I don't know if you have any ideas around that.
Well, I've thought about it. I don't know if what's happened with gay rights is a good example, you know, to... No. The point I'm going to make is this, though. We've seen a dramatic shift in attitudes toward gay rights. That's true. And so people will hopefully look at that and they will say, are we going to see the same kind of shift in this arena? But the problem is that the gay rights is not primarily an economic issue. It's not something that involves taking money from some group of people and giving it to another group of people. And I think that in the economic arena, you are likely to run into more resistance, especially from conservatives. I mean, I would say maybe it sounds a bit cynical, but part of the reason that the gay rights have advanced so quickly is that wealthy people can and are, in fact, gay and know people that are gay. However, wealthy people, by definition, are not poor, so they don't have that same connection that they have there. So I think that creates more of a problem.
Do you feel like this is more of almost a product of overpopulation on our planet? It seems like technology has compounded as population has increased. You think we just need to maybe go back to controlling more our reproduction rates? I don't know. I mean,
well,
overpopulating. I think technology is following along that, and we're not going to be able to keep up with it. So,
I mean, I'm not sure there's a direct link between population and information technology, other than that you have more human brains to work on the technology and create new things. But in fact, in developed advanced countries, we are already sort of on that path. You know, we're not having as many children, especially in countries in Europe and so forth, as some are actually seeing declining populations. So that's more of an issue in the developing world, I think. I'm not sure I would really link it to the advance of technology.
Well, I think along the lines that he was talking about our changing of values, what about our changing of values of how we value work? Like, why do we value a 40-hour work so much? Why can't we value a 10-hour work, you know, work week or no work? Why, you know, that's, I think when people are talking about it, like, well, what are 90% of the people going to do? Well, you know, why isn't our answer nothing? Something else, something that, you know, maybe is productive in another way that isn't the way we value it today. But people can't do that right now because they have to make money. You know, I think maybe that's more the shift of values that he was talking about.
Right. Well, there are two separate issues there. One is, how are you going to get a sense of fulfillment in a world where maybe you don't have to work? And you know, it's fairly recent in human history that people have taken so much of the meaning of their life from their work. I mean, there are plenty of examples already of things you can do that are very fulfilling that don't pay. For example, you can go and spend a lot of time editing Wikipedia. You can, if you're a software programmer, you can do open source software, things like that. There are plenty of things to do that offer people meaningful you know, experiences that don't necessarily pay money. So I think that that whole issue of changing our values toward work is important, but the immediate issue is going to be distributional. It's going to be about people not having access to incomes, and what do we do about that? That's going to be the first problem that we face. Perhaps. I mean, I would hope so. I mean, that's sort of the idea of a guaranteed income, is that you give everyone a minimal income and then they can do, you know, the things that are fulfilling. I've also suggested in the book that we might tie that to certain incentives, so that we might pay people a little more if they invest in education or if they work in the community or do other productive things. So I think those are good ideas. I don't know if they're ideas that conservatives are going to be likely to buy into anytime soon, though.
That distribution seems to be at the core of the problem, and it seems that this is almost a law of nature. So this advancement follows Moore's law, and if we could tax the sunrise, and that would be enough to, you know, supply all of our needs, that'd be great. We can't tax the sunrise, but this is a law of nature that we can tax. And so I think ultimately taxing not just productivity, but increases in productivity, which are different. It's a difference between taxing acceleration versus taxing speed. Do you think there's a way to insert that into the conversation, that we're not going to tax your productivity, we're going to tax increases in productivity?
It's an interesting idea. I think that, you know, that it's inevitable that part of this is going to have to be taxing, you know, basically the people at the very top, that are where all the wealth is concentrated. Politically, that's very difficult, but I mean, that's where the income is going, and I think it's going to get worse and worse. I think we're likely to see even more extreme inequality going forward, you know, more and more of income basically being hoovered up by a tiny number of people at the top. And as I mentioned, that really undermines the whole economy because it takes demand out. So one hope I have is that as this progresses, the people at the very top will recognize that, you know, they need a market. They need a reasonable distribution of income and purchasing power so that they have customers out there to buy the things that they produce. So perhaps that offers some hope that eventually what we might call the plutocracy, the people that, you know, who hold real power, will sort of come to realize this and buy into it a little bit more.
So have you considered that despite the job loss, that it might actually be better for the survival of the species as a whole? And I'll throw out like a typical or a, like an example there that I popped into my mind. Like, what if the answer to global warming is, you know, lies in having some smart robots that can help us prevent that from destroying the Earth?
Well, I mean, that's a hopeful scenario. I think that if we can leverage this technology in a way that makes everyone secure and also helps to address those types of problems, then yeah, that's a possible outcome. One of the things I worry about, though, that I talk a bit about in the book, is that, you know, as we move to more inequality and more economic insecurity for a lot of people, that can sort of unfold in parallel with global warming. So we may have these two things essentially happening at the same time, and they're going to sort of reinforce and feed off each other to a certain extent. I mean, one of the things we know now is that if you are someone who opposes doing anything about climate change, the easiest thing to do is simply point out that any action is going to result in job losses. I mean, you know, there's like a one-word answer to any kind of initiative to do anything about this, and that's jobs. So as people become more insecure, they're going to focus on the near term. They're going to worry about, how am I going to pay my rent this month? And it's going to be a lot harder for them to focus on longer term issues. And therefore, I think it will be much harder to get the kind of political support that you would need to actually do anything about these problems if we don't, you know, adapt to this.
An anecdote or something like that. During the great depression in the U.S., for example, when people were out of work, birth rate dropped very, very low. So, you know, in terms of the fact that there are no jobs, there's no security, and so on, you know, will that, either through the four horsemen of the apocalypse, war, pestilence, famines, and so on, will those things be a self-correcting mechanism in the future?
Well, I mean, that happened in the Great Recession, too. In the most recent crisis, the birth rate fell. But, of course, having the birth rate fall, it takes, you know, a couple of decades before that translates into fewer people in the workforce and so forth. So I mean, I suppose that to some extent that's a solution, but it's not the solution we would want. I mean, that's kind of like what happens out in the natural world in animal populations, right? When they run out of food, they all starve. I don't think that's our hope for humanity. So it's not the solution I would choose.
Yeah, but another future technology-related question, not on the economic side. I'm curious, there's been a lot more serious talk lately about the potential perils of artificial intelligence and sort of taking over. And the thing that we used to think about was science fiction. Now serious people like Bill Gates and Elon Musk and, you know, Stephen Hawking have serious concern about whether technology may become more intelligent than us and start to become a threat. And, you know, Elon Musk recently donated $10 million to, you know, to just study this. So I'm just curious as to, do you think that this is a serious threat? And if so, how does it correlate to some of the things that you've been talking about with the economic threats?
Right. I think that it's something that should not be just completely dismissed or laughed at. But I don't think that it's going to happen anytime soon, based on what I've heard from the people that are really working with these technologies. Most of them are concerned about this. It's interesting that the people that are issuing these warnings, people like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, obviously they're very smart, very accomplished people, but they're not artificial intelligence workers. They're not engaged in the nuts and bolts of trying to build these systems. So I think that if you talk to the people that are really trying to build this stuff, they're more humble about where we are now, and they're not really at all concerned about this. They realize that it's pretty far in the future. But I mean, if you think in terms of several decades from now, 50 years from now or something, it could be a genuine concern, yes. I do think that for the foreseeable future, though, this economic impact, and in particularly the impact on jobs, is going to be much more significant, because it doesn't take science fiction technology to do that. It just takes the technology that we have now and you know, just sort of extend it forward logically, and you run into a pretty obvious problem.
Okay, one more question. So I gather you're not optimistic of an outbreak of shame, huh? I remember a couple of years ago that I guess it was Warren Buffett said it was ridiculous that his secretary was paying a lower tax rate than he was. And I think in the history of this, pardon me? A higher tax rate than he was. And in the history of this country, some of the wealthiest people have died some of the most horrible deaths. So the notion that these people at the top are just going to be able to get away with this and laugh their, you know, their ass off behind a gate, I just don't think that's realistic. So do you have any hope that shame will break out at some point?
I mean, one can hope. I think that, you know, you can look at the response to Warren Buffett's comment. I mean, his fellow plutocrats responded by saying, well, if you want to pay more taxes, just go ahead and send in a check. I think that's what a lot of them said. So I don't know. So far, we see that they can push this pretty far. And the regular people are all watching Fox News and getting their news from that. So, it's kind of hard to see how this evolves. I mean, we did see, obviously, Occupy Wall Street, but it didn't really, you know, become something transformative, did it? So at some point we may see, you know, we may see that, but I think it would be overly optimistic to expect that.
Hi. You mentioned Moore's Law. Oh, I'm sorry. You mentioned Moore's Law, and there's another law I'm thinking of, and I'm not sure if it was coined by, Isaac Asimov, about if you're communicating
with a machine, and whether you could tell it's a human or a machine.
Yeah, that's the Turing test. Yeah.
Turing test. Thank you. I'm just curious. One of the phenomenon that amuses me is the idea of tweeting, and I'm curious. Do you know of any experiments that have been done where people have been completely fooled yet about whether they're actually tweeting with another individual or a machine? I'm just curious on something.
Yeah,
like
they have an actual Turing test that they you know, an actual contest every year, and there have been some algorithms that have in theory passed it. There was one recently that it was a system that pretended to be a teenager. And was actually to fool other people into believing that it was human. So, you know, my take on the Turing test is that it's kind of a test of imitation. I mean, it's about an algorithm or a system, you know, pretending to be a person. It's not really a test of true artificial intelligence. I think that, so I don't really view it as especially important, although it's obviously got a famous name attached to it. I think that if someday we have a machine that can really think like a human being and converse like a human being, that it'll be pretty obvious. We won't need a test to know that.
In the past, we weren't supposed to ever tax job creators because, well, they were creating jobs and doing good things. So we've led to big, you know, tax cuts, subsidies, and so forth. But in Jaron Lanier's book, Who Owns the Future, he kind of looks back, describes how the middle class got, you know, pretty much demolished by everybody doing work for free, like writing journalist stories or giving information to Facebook that they then monetized. You know, as people are organizing for a basic income, and I think that's starting to bubble up some, you know, do you see that as like maybe that's our share of that economy that we used to get paid for and no longer do?
Yeah, I mean, that's one approach. I think that another name for a guaranteed income is a citizen's dividend, and it sort of captures the idea that everyone ought to be entitled to some cut of the economy. And the way I would put it is that the people that are doing extraordinarily well, of course, do rely on in effect, the infrastructure of capitalism, things like markets and institutions, you know, our legal process, our courts, property rights. And they also rely on this accumulated, what you might call technological capital. I mean, we've had this innovation going on for decades now in a doubling process. Many, many people have contributed to that over decades or even over hundreds of years if you want to go back far enough. So I think you can make a pretty good argument that, you know, to some extent that should belong to everyone and that maybe everyone should get at least some sort of a minimal income on the basis of that. So it'd be sort of treating technology like a resource, like oil in the ground, and there are a number of countries and a state, Alaska, that have sovereign wealth funds based on that actually pay incomes to people. So I think that's a good idea, yeah.
And now for our last question.
You said machines can learn. Is there any way to put a boundary on that, on machine intelligence?
I mean, technically, maybe, but I mean, it won't happen. I mean, this is something that's really driven by a competitive dynamic. I mean, you've got Google competing with Amazon, competing with Facebook to build these technologies. They're raiding each other's workforces, stealing away the smartest people working on these technologies. I think you're going to have competition between countries because these technologies are really important to national security and to the surveillance state and all of that. So you're going to have competition between the United States and China. So in that kind of environment, how can you stop it? I mean, you know, you there's no way to pass a law, even if it were a good idea to do that. It's effectively unstoppable. So I think that our challenge is really to adapt to it, to figure out a way to live with it and work with it in the future. That's a possibility. That's the fear that Elon Musk has, right, that it could eventually get out of control. But I think that lies much further in the future.
Our thanks to Martin Ford. We also thank our audience, as well as those listening to the recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.